Podcast listeners, summer's here, and hope everyone's doing great. This is Sammy Anand, your MC secretary-elect, with a summary of May's offerings for healthy intersections. That's right, you heard that. Lisa will explain more on this new name, so stay tuned. In the first part of May, we have two great articles discussing viewpoints in Dr. Michael Fine's book, Healthcare Revolt. The book explores the themes of healthcare being a marketplace and not a system that is in place to help people. The authors of the two articles offer viewpoints on what should be done to implement better systemic change and who should shoulder that burden. Is a revolt needed? And when is the best time? And what's the best strategy? This is a topic that brings up constant discussion in the healthcare and public health communities. So head to the blog to read it and provide your own insights. We want to know what you think. Next, Jess Williams has written about Medical Care's new peer review mentoring program that will match interested students and early career researchers to experienced reviewers. Mentors and mentees, head to the blog for more information and to sign up for this program. And we finished the month with author Cynthia Miller with a post on diabetes cure or diabetes management, which explores the new proposed solutions, high-intensity care and lifestyle change as primary management for diabetes. As the diabetes burden continues to significantly rise in the U.S., and more because of COVID-19 lockdowns and the new normal, she explores the feasibility of the various options proposed. Now let's look at the June Medical Care Journal offerings. I want to highlight just a few. Our own medical care team members have worked on a beloved commentary that we are offering the full text for readers for free on the Medical Care Journal, endorsing the single-payer health system reform. Medical care has always been a strong supporter of this topic, so please take some time to read this. It's a great read. The journal also has articles on COVID-19 trends, the racial and ethnic differences in hospitalizations, a randomized controlled trial on cognitive behavior therapy for long-term opioid patients, and applied methods on measuring inconsistency in quality among patient groups to target quality improvement. Head to the journal and blog to read more. Now, on this month's episode, we have Lisa Lines, co-editor of the Medical Care blog, interviewing Dr. Pia McDonald, a noted infectious disease epidemiologist at RTI. Here's to you, Lisa.
Hello, listeners. This is Lisa Lines, Senior Health Services Researcher at RTI International, and one of the co-hosts for the Healthy Intersections podcast. And yes, that's right, listeners, we have renamed our podcast. The idea is that this podcast is at the intersection between medical care and public health, just as the Medical Care Journal and the Medical Care blog are. And we're really excited to also feature some excellent interviews and conversations at that intersection. Today, we are delighted to have Dr. Pia McDonald, a senior director and senior research epidemiologist at RTI International, with over 25 years of experience in epidemiologic research and public health. Dr. McDonald, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
As an infectious disease expert, you've been very close to the action, so to speak, when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic. What has that been like for you?
It's been a whirlwind of feelings and emotions, and I would say I've been at times terrified. I've found it very depressing. It's been heart-wrenching. There's been feelings of being invigorated, but at the same time feeling hopeless, and other times hopeful, and all in between. It's felt a lot like a grief cycle in terms of various phases of the pandemic, as well as my own feelings about where we were. So there's been denial, there's been the anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and then a lot of back and forth among these over the past 2 years. But I will say I feel like that grief cycle fits pretty well in terms of where I've been, but also where I've seen collectively as a society we've been. And then I would also say that I've learned a lot, and I hope I've grown a lot too. So I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned about more about public health, about leadership, politics, government, and then much, much more.
Wow, that's a lot. It certainly has been an unprecedented time. And, you know, like many of us, I'm wondering, has life in the US changed forever because of the pandemic? Or do you think things will go back to relatively normal someday?
I think there's a lot of things I think that have changed. It's hard to predict how long they'll change because many people keep reminding me that while I've seen so many important shifts, a lot of people tell me, well, we forget very, very quickly as a society. So who knows how long this is going to last. So I would say, though, that there are shifts taking place in society. And I think examples of that are, for example, like what is the workplace of the future going to look like? And similarly, in response to what we've learned about COVID, I think we'll reconsider the design of school and workplaces in the future in terms of being more intentional around air circulation and ventilation and crowding. Mm-hmm. And then similarly, as SARS-CoV-2 has become lodged as an endemic disease, we're going to see more and more people using personal protective equipment like N95s, and they'll be visible not only for preventing SARS-CoV-2, but also seasonal respiratory viruses like influenza. So those are just some of the ways that I see things changing in the near-term future. But in the long-term future, I think it's hard to tell. I think as a collection of, you know, people in society, we've become way more aware of how interconnected we are with the globe in terms of disease spread. And there's been many, many people who have become what I call armchair epidemiologists and really learned to look at data that I've spent, you know, many, many years looking at, but they've become very good at looking at data as well about COVID cases and hospitalizations and immunization rates in ways that I think has led to, you know, us as a society becoming more educated and trained to pay attention to disease and how that impacts on our communities.
Yeah, you know, we had a blog post recently about that very thing. One of our contributors wrote to about his patients and how they have a lot more knowledge in the community about public health. And maybe it's time for us now with this increased visibility to take advantage of that and not allow public health to go back to the backdrop or the background, but really keeping it in people's eyes and on top of mind.
I'd love to see that moving forward. That'd be my dream.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us in public health feel the same way that, so, I mean, I'm wondering, what is your biggest fear about the next phase of the pandemic or I guess endemic? I mean, what should our listeners be worried about at this point?
I think even in my own community and even in my own family, I think that pandemic fatigue is real. And it's as if we want to wish away all these waves that keep coming. But really, it's clear that the variant waves will keep coming. And already now, you know, at the end of May, there's a new wave in South Africa. And that's been a place for us to look at what our future a few months before could look like. So right now we see there the BA4 variant being outcompeted by the BA5 variant, which is causing a surge in cases. And that is likely indicative of that happening in the United States in terms of right now we're in the BA2.12 wave, and we can see in the out months potentially a BA4 or BA5 wave coming. And I think with that is just making sure that we're all aware that these waves will keep coming, at least for the foreseeable future, and understanding how that does impact us. And the very important thing that we keep learning with each of these waves is that immunization and staying up to date on the boosters is extremely important in preventing severe illness and death. It is not, I mean, it is very important to be vaccinated that first time, but it is also important to continually get the boosters when they're offered to us.
Right. I think a lot of people are so tired of it all that they've just given up. And I think that's you know, the point about coming waves and being able to see them coming. I mean, we've got to pay attention to the hidden, you know, I mean, with many, many tests happening sort of at home now, I feel like we're kind of flying blind.
Yes. And I will say we're growing, we're also learning as we go. So I think, you know, for every individual understanding, we're learning more and more about, okay, now that we're testing at home, how reliable are the tests we're using? Mm. What does it mean for me in terms of changing my day-to-day behavior if I've been exposed, if I need to test over, you know, the next few days after being exposed? But again, what we need to keep in mind is that with each of these variants, we need to re-examine, do our tests work to detect those variants? Do the many mushrooming tests that are available at home, do all of them work equally? Are we using the test kits according to the manufacturer's instructions? Because there's so much variation in not only the test kits, but also in the way we're using them individually, that they're not a gold standard. The best we have right now is the PCR tests being administered in a clinical setting. Rapid test kits that are in the homes are very helpful, but they are not an answer for knowing definitively if I'm at risk of passing along the virus to others. And there's many reasons behind that. But I would also make sure that listeners keep in mind that with each of the new variants, we need to understand what changes about the epidemiology of the virus and the epidemiology of the disease. And so understanding, we have to ask ourselves that every time there is a new variant, do our therapeutics work? How well does the vaccine work? How well does previous infection provide antibodies that protect us? And there's a continual need to develop and hone our therapeutics as well as continue to advance the vaccine so that they stay abreast with how the virus is changing globally.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, in what ways is this like the Spanish flu pandemic? And in what ways is it different so far? I mean, from your perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question and one that, you know, there'll be books written about, I think, in the future. But, you know, at the most obvious to me are in some of the ways that they are similar is that politics have played a role in the response. We've also seen a lot of variation regionally in the United States as well as globally. There's also similarly misinformation out there. I think at the time of the Spanish flu, there was similar misinformation out there. You know, hard to understand the disease, hard to understand the new virus. What was it? How is it transmitted? And because there were so many unknowns at that time, there was a lot of opportunity for misinformation. I think those are some of the similarities. And then in some of the ways that they're different are very, very important as well, in that therapeutics, vaccination, and medical care have advanced immensely since then. So if you think about at that time, even though they're both viral pathogens, one of the problems with flu or influenza is that it is a viral infection at first, but the sequela can be bacterial in nature. And at that time, there were no antibiotics. And now, similarly, there can be sequela that are bacterial with SARS-CoV-2, but we do have antibiotics now. We also have antiviral therapeutics. Right. We also have, within 1 year, had a effective vaccine to mitigate severe illness and death. So, I mean, those are some very significant differences in terms of where we are in history. Mm-hmm. The other things that are different now, though, is sort of the speed of information, and that's the social media and more interconnectedness of people and news feeds and all that kind of stuff. And then I think one difference could be, and this I don't know as much about, but it seems to me that there's the deep polarization of prevention measures that we know work, such as masking and vaccination. The politicizing of that has been, you know, very, very unfortunate. And and I don't know that that was the same in around the time of the Spanish.
They published something of a takedown piece in The Atlantic called How Public Health Failed America. He specifically points a finger at us and people like us, university-based physicians, epidemiologists, and virologists, and I quote, opining about what the government should do without fully understanding or communicating what is feasible, affordable, legal, and politically acceptable for public health agencies. What's your perspective? Are academics totally out of touch?
So, like Jay Varma, I've also worked in state level and federal level public health. Mm-hmm. And also been on faculty at the University of North Carolina in the Department of Epidemiology at the Gillings School of Global Public Health, and also now work at RTI as infectious disease epidemiologist. So I feel very fortunate to have had that experience in applied public health at the state, at the local, and at the federal level. I think there's a lot about our public health infrastructure and system that is very different from, I think, what the public thinks it is, what academic researchers think it is. And so I do find that I resonate with what Dr. Varma is saying in that article. So, for example, the legality of state and local health departments and how they operate, and in terms of what data systems they can use, what information they can share, all of that is governed at different levels and differently across the United States. And that's something that has incredible ramifications for anything that we try to do nationally, for example, with data. And there's also that infrastructure has been so critically underfunded for so long that just piling on money, that solves one problem, but it doesn't solve the local capacity to expand their staffing, expand contracts, expand data systems, and things like that. It's just... money is not the only constraint to expanding their ability to do response work, for example. So I think there's many factors that that he highlights that are indeed accurate from my perspective. And I would say some of the benefits from this time are that more academics have gotten better aware and worked closer with public health. So for example, there have been many examples across the United States of states, state health departments turning to their universities to help them with whether it be disease modeling or contact tracing or doing genetic sequencing of isolates or other things. That really has nicely bridged those two entities. But in generally speaking, there's a lot of university-based physicians and epidemiologists who have never actually practiced public health and understand what that system and infrastructure looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point really is that the separation, this artificial separation between public health, to me, I mean, to me, it seems artificial, between public health and medical care or health care. We've got to find better ways to actually bridge those gaps, those gulfs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and our healthcare system sometimes feels like a slow motion train wreck. So let's end on a high note. And what gives you hope for the future in terms of U.S. healthcare and public health?
I think there's a few things here. And one I alluded to just now, and that is that there have been academics who have started to work more closely with state and local and federal health departments, and similarly, vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think each of those entities benefits a lot from that collaboration. So moving forward, I'd love to see an investment in that linkage and making that a permanent linkage. So
yeah,
funding academia and funding public health entities to work together on collaborative projects and initiatives, thereby educating new people for the workforce, as well as bringing new infrastructure, technology, tools, and knowledge into the public health system. So, you know, not only from a workforce capacity pipeline aspect, but also a transfer of knowledge back and forth, mm-hmm, to advance each of them, right? So the academic researchers may be inspired to focus more on research that has public health application, and then public health be more inspired by some of the more innovative and futuristic tools that are being developed in the research setting and having them then applied more in the public health setting. So I'd like to see a fusion of those two entities moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, I think there is a growing appreciation of universal health care and coverage and interoperable and flexible data systems, for example, like electronic medical records. So we in the United States are benefiting greatly from the fact that the United Kingdom has universal health care coverage as well as electronic medical records. So a lot of findings about SARS-CoV-2, as well as the new variants, and understanding the epidemiology and the clinical features and all these things that are coming from places that have integrated systems and universal health coverage, like, mm-hmm, the United Kingdom. And, mm-hmm, so I think we're seeing the benefits of that and recognizing domestically that there are major challenges when there aren't a lot of cohesion in both the medical care infrastructure as well as the public health infrastructure. So that's one thing. I think electronic medical records will help both entities, healthcare providers as well as the public health infrastructure. And there is a growing effort to bridge those better so that electronic medical records can be used for public health to improve our ability to prevent, detect, and respond to population level disease threats. Mm-hmm. And that's coming with the data modernization initiative and the amount of investment in that from a federal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece I would add is that there's been really exemplary public-private partnerships that we've seen in this response that have been able to accelerate, for example, what the public side of public health has been able to do. So an example of that is for testing.
Mm.
There's been, you know, where the state and local health department infrastructure has struggled in terms of being able to pop up testing sites, you know, all over states.
Mm.
In some states, other private entities have taken that piece on and done a lot of data sharing with the state so that they were both benefiting from doing that work, right? Because they were working in partnership, they could ensure the data from the testing went to the state, and then the state could ensure that there was testing available all over the state or where it was needed most at that time. So I think there's been a lot of new public-private partnerships in the overall response, and that was just one example, but I think there's been many more. And all of those give me hope that in the next time we have to do this, which we will, that we'll be better prepared even as these fractured systems. But in that, we'll have more experience working together, both from the public-private, but also the academic, public, and everyone in between. There's just more practice, more relationships on how to take advantage of what each sector has to offer.
Well, that is a hopeful note, and I really appreciate you taking the time to sit with us today, Dr. McDonald, and I hope that you get some time off to rest and recharge. And just thank you so much for all of that you do.
Thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to future discussions.